defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
So we've been hearing a lot about the Green New Deal and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being the bearer of that Green New Deal. And I'd like to remind people that George Foster with the Blue-Green Alliance had been talking about that over a decade ago. I mean, this is not new policy. And what I heard over the weekend from people is that, you know, this is her brainchild. And what I give AOC credit for is that she's taken ideas that people have been organizing around for quite some time, and she has now brought them into the limelight and brought some juice with it. And this is the important thing. You know, so when the idiot goes, well, you know, she got a 430 credit score and filed bankruptcy, and which is completely false, and I guess you can make things up about people whenever you want and not have to fear libel, especially if you're a politician. But, you know, this is, to me, I don't want to make these issues solely about AOC. I want to make them about, hey, how do we move the country forward? How do we move society forward? And how do we defend workers and their rights? So to me, the Green New Deal is a way we should be looking at making sure that, you know, we deal with climate change issues, but also an economy that works for everybody. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how we do some of that in the world of transit, because as AOC said, she wants to see people walking, biking, and oh, by the way, taking public transit. That's why I've asked John Samuelson to come talk with us. He's the international president of the Transport Workers Union, TWU. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's jump into this a little bit. I'm curious your thoughts of the initial proposal. It's bare bones at this point. But what are your thoughts on the Green New Deal at this point?
Well, I think you described it accurately, right, that there have been elements of this Green New Deal that have been around for quite some time. And even if Ocasio-Cortez, you know, even if it's not her brainchild, certainly she deserves the credit for putting all of this into the national dialogue, yep. Which it is.
Yeah, but I don't want to put personal and political capital into it. Right. I don't want to make it all about her, because when the media tears her down, and I assume at some point that's going to happen, I don't want to see this take a dive. I don't want to see the juice that's coming around about taxing the very wealthy at higher rates. I don't want to see that go down. There's a lot of policy initiatives that have been tied to her that I fear the game plan is build her up and then shred her.
Yeah, I think she should be concerned about that, too. I think she might want to concern herself with the Democratic Party itself, building her up and shredding her. there's elements of this that are wonderful, right?
Yep.
But it's not even a bill. It's a resolution. And we have a situation in the United States of America where the most important city in the country, the subway system, is still in a complete state of disrepair, or at least it's improved over the last couple of years, but because of this investment, the New York City subway system just went through a prolonged period of turmoil. So, there's just even a fundamentally smart thing to do, like invest in the New York City transit system, hasn't even been accomplished. So, some of the other goals here just seem far off to me, unless the folks that make the laws in this country put their political capital on the line and really start putting their money where their mouth is and start doing something.
No, I agree with you.
We have a situation here where infrastructure is falling apart across the entire country. There was the discussion about high-speed rail came in, you know, at least with the very beginning of the Obama administration, if not earlier. And to my knowledge, there's been no movement on high-speed rail. So this is all talk until somebody actually does something.
No, and to me, this is why it's important. And you're right. It's a non-binding resolution at this point. For me, it's kind of a conversation starter. There's not a snowball's chance in hell of this ever passing in this current climate. But it's about getting people to think about, you know, where we're going, where we need to go, and potential ideas of where we're going. And sadly to me, as I said in the opening, you know, the response I got from my Trump clan is that the whole plan boils down to we're just going to stop cows from having flatulence, which is just insane. But I guess that's the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, there's a whole lot going on here, but there's a whole lot of ideas in play. And those, and particularly as they relate to public transit or public transportation, whether it be in aviation or in inner city transit systems like New York or Philadelphia, unless they come up with the money and actually invest in the infrastructure, all of this is a moot discussion. It means nothing.
That's a good point.
So these conversations have to lead to concrete bills and concrete budgeting at the federal, state, and local level to invest in infrastructure. And, you know, if she's done nothing less, or the folks that signed on to the resolution have done nothing less than begin a conversation and put it into the collective conversation of America, then that's a really good thing.
No, and you hit on the important part. You got to be able to pay for it, which is why I thought it's important to talk about a top marginal tax, right? And you think about the last time we had really a nationwide major investment in infrastructure. You go back to the 1950s in the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower, when they built the highway system. We had a top marginal tax rate back then of 92%.
Isn't that ironic that JFK was the supply side Reaganomics guy before Ronald Reagan? You know, while Ronald Reagan was still probably an FDR guy, to be honest.
Exactly. And, you know, obviously JFK dropped the rate from 92 down to 70%, did do the whole close the loophole things for a bit. And then when Reagan took on, obviously from 70 down to eventually to 28%, which again, you know, caused our massive ballooning debt. But we got to have these conversations of one, how we invest in the future, because it's coming. And the thing that bothers me is, you know, is China is investing heavily in this stuff while we're still creating billionaires.
And Europe, the whole world, in fact, the whole world. There's we're talking even the Gateway Tunnel, which is one of the most important tunnels and one of the most important corridors in the world, is just it's just not getting done. The tunnel is going to implode before politicians get done debating it. So we're in a kind of a dire situation. And just aside from the overall extremely important background of climate change, there's a fundamental disconnect between politicians in Washington and investment in public transit infrastructure. Every public transit system in America is suffering right now.
Yep.
Every single one. But the airline industry is not suffering. The airline industry is actually highly profitable. And one question I had that's as of yet unanswered is what are the intentions of the Green New Dealers in the aviation industry? If we're talking about converting an aviation industry, a robust industry that employs hundreds of thousands of Americans in solid blue collar jobs, how do they anticipate converting over the aviation industry to a green economy in 12 years? It's really not possible.
No, and I absolutely agree with that. I mean, you know, you're not going to be able to get across the country in a couple of hours via train. But, you know, the short hop stuff, I can see, you know, if we had high speed rail, if we truly as a country invested in that, I can see how you could do it on the short stuff. I don't know how you do international or long or, you know, cross country. You're right. But again, this is back to the point of these are conversations we have to have on what does that look like? What does the future look like? Because we're at a time where I don't think most people understand how transformative the next 10 years are going to be. I mean, we're looking at, I think, disruptive forces that we haven't seen in this country since the Industrial Revolution.
I agree. And we've talked about that a lot before, in terms of automation and automation's impact on public transit and in blue collar America in general. This is the displacement of jobs due to automation is going to make NAFTA look like something fairly benign. That's where we're headed right now.
Yeah, and this is where there's an opportunity, I think, for labor to start. You know, back in the 1950s, there were a number of unions advocating for a 24-hour work week. I think he's starting to push for shorter work weeks, more job training, more things like that. And also kind of a universal basic income thing, because there are going to be lots of losers. I mean, the last study I saw on this said, you know, and this has been a couple of years, said in 20 years, half of the jobs we currently are employed with will be gone because AI is going to take it. Look, I'm a truck driver. I predict in 10 years there'll be no more long haul truck driver jobs.
Yeah, you're right. Universal basic income almost seems like an inevitability to me. The amount of money that these corporations are going to be making by getting rid of workers in favor of automation, the amount of money is just, it's immeasurable. The profit is immeasurable. And there'll be a revolution in the United States. There'll be a revolution if automation displaces half the workforce.
Yeah, because, you know, I look at this, and one of the things that's been scary to me, and I've been talking about this for a while, is our elected officials aren't paying attention to this or don't appear to outwardly be discussing this. And this is where this Green New Deal thing kind of gives me, you know, a little bit of hope that they're kind of, you know, putting in that, hey, people should have the right to a job. People should have the right to health care, the right to, you know, some retirement security, the right to a vacation, family leave, that they're actually talking about what the workplace is going to look like in the future and making sure that people have employment. So to me, that I think is important because, look, if the private sector is not going to or can't create enough jobs for everyone, I do believe the public sector has a responsibility to do it.
Well, certainly the federal government has stepped in before in times of crisis and created programs to employ American workers. We're in a different world right now, though, right? Under FDR, when Americans went back to work and then they used the money from their paychecks to buy shoes or to buy whatever, radios, they were made in America. So it had this whole residual effect on the economy.
Right.
This brave new world that we're in now. It sort of renders New Deal, original New Deal economics, you know, a little bit obsolete because we're buying stuff that's made in China now. We'd be stimulating the Chinese economy through something like universal basic income. But certainly this whole discussion about a Green New Deal and how we transition from whether it be automation or whether it be intentionally transitioning to a greener form of energy in the transportation industry, the unions right now need to be like forward on this. They need to be looking absolutely forward or they're going to get decimated. You spoke about politicians perhaps not looking forward enough, and certainly the trade union movement falls into that category. And we've spoken about the fight in Columbus, Ohio before on this show, over 500 bus operators who were potentially facing displacement because of automation. And, you know, we've won the early stages of that fight. But certainly cities where there's not a transport workers union or another union that's fighting effectively are going to fall prey to automation, and bus operators and mechanics are going to quickly start losing their jobs. And it's going to be like a domino effect across the whole country, across every industry.
No, and that's the scary part to me. So the question then becomes, how does labor deal with this? I mean, you know, the idea of being a Luddite and smashing the machines, I don't think is going to work. How do you balance the demands of your members against the realities of an industry that, you know, just is going that way without, because the technology's there.
So the way the union movement deals with the way the trade union movement deals with this is to fight back against the corporations that are China. Automate things, not to improve society, but automate things to line their pockets and to increase stock earnings and whatnot.
Right.
And you know, that type of fight back has happened. And it's happened in New York City, where they've had the ability to run automated trains since the 50s. And yet there's a two-person train crew on the subway because of trade union fight backs, because of transport workers union fight backs in New York. And the same thing in Columbus, Ohio, where there's a willingness to fight. You can win. But if you don't fight, we're never going to win.
Right. So ultimately, it's going to come back down to, you know, you go back and you learn the history of the labor movement, the organizing that went on in the teens and the 20s that, you know, eventually bore benefits into the late 30s and 40s. It's all about getting people active, engaged, and organized and ready to take to the streets and make the fight. So are we going to relive that history of the labor movement, you think?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely possible. I think the labor movement right now objectively is bouncing back. There have been some really significant wins in the labor movement, and even preceding this wave of successful teacher strikes, and certainly there's more to come. We'll see what happens with the government shutdown. We'll see what happens as Trump moves forward with this kind of anti-worker agenda over the next couple of years. But my belief, and both anecdotally and this is what the data says, is that the trade union movement is bouncing back. And the trade union movement is really the only thing that's protecting working Americans against the move toward automation, and perhaps even against politicians who want to usher in a Green New Deal without any consultation with workers.
No, and that's an important point.
They're more important than ever right now.
No, you're absolutely. It's important to have that worker's voice at the table, and you know, as the saying goes, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, and it's important to have people, you know, standing up and fighting back. But you know, you brought up the shutdown, and I did want to get your thoughts on this. You know, you look at that 35-day shutdown, and to me, more than ever, the reality of the need for labor unions and the need for workers to have more power on the job. You know, it was bore out in what we saw that, you know, we're a working class on the edge of desperation, and it doesn't matter who you work for. You know, virtually everyone in this country is a paycheck or two away from chaos. And even the people that we thought were fairly well off being our federal workers, you know, they're struggling just like everybody else.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I tell you one hidden gem. Well, it's really not hidden, is that despite all the efforts of politicians in Washington, and despite the efforts of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and others to break Trump, the folks that broke Trump were air traffic controllers, and it really wasn't a lot of them either. That were just stressed, overworked, and actually just couldn't cope anymore. And when they didn't show up to work, it had the effect of a strike, even though it wasn't a strike, and they're prohibited from striking, but nonetheless, it had the effect of a strike, and that's what broke Trump. And there's a lesson to be learned there for everybody.
No, I've been one of the people calling for a general strike. They do it again. Nobody should go to work. Shut everything down. If it is that important that you're going to force people to work without pay, every federal worker should take to the streets. I think it would only take one day.
Yeah, I think the shutdown also exposed a lot of vulnerabilities in the labor movement. Right, to pull off a general strike. There might be local unions in the country, but I don't think there's one national union that's prepared across the board in every city to engage in a general strike right now.
Yeah, so
there are transport workers union locals in cities across America that have the organization in place to pull it off, and many other unions other than mine that would be in that situation. But organized labor is, you know, this is a vulnerability that's become stock now.
So is this now the clarion call to do more internal organizing?
Absolutely. Automation, the combination, this 2018 going into 2019, everything is hitting the fan for the trade union movement. This is like you said, this is a transformative 10 years that are coming. And the way that we're going to land on our feet after 10 years is by organizing. It isn't by sitting around talking to politicians in Washington.
It's about, you know, disrupting. So again, we're ending up right back where we started. Turn of the century, early 1920s. Going to be an interesting couple of years, I think. And John, I appreciate some of your thoughts. I'd love to have you back again because this is not going away anytime soon. And I'd love to keep in touch.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with the shutdown. Hopefully, we don't have a repeat.
I'm with you. John Samuelson, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. He's the international president of the Transport Workers Union, TWU. You can check out their website, twu.org. Some great folks over there. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.